This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Xiaomi has announced a range of new phones under the 12S moniker, and more specifically the 12S Ultra, which is the first ultra-premium flagship of its Leica partnership era. But what does the new partnership mean? Does the new phone have the tech to impress, and when will you be able to get one? Apocalypse's Cam Bunton joins me to discuss the announcement. Meanwhile, I've been talking to Sam Kemp at EE about how the UK mobile phone network provided the communications infrastructure at this year's Glastonbury, what the big trends were, and what it tells us for the future. And finally, Apocalypse's Max Freeman-Mills has been playing with the new Samsung TV gaming hub that's just rolled out on the company's range of 2022 televisions. Is it any good? Stay tuned to find out. But first, back to you, Cam. Tell us more about the Xiaomi announcement.
So there were a couple of big things that came out of announcement. Obviously, the main news is Xiaomi launched this new 12S series of phones, and it includes three different models, which is the 12S, the 12S Pro, and the 12S Ultra. But it's only the last of those three that's really the exciting launch, because the 12S and the 12S Pro are essentially just slightly spec-bumped versions of phones that already existed.
And so tell us more about the Ultra. This is the one with the Leica partnership, isn't it?
Yeah, they all have the Leica branding on them, which means that some of the color and filters have been tweaked to Leica's preference, and they've got a special coating on the lenses. But yeah, the 12S Ultra is the big daddy. It's the one with the 1-inch sensor that they've spent a lot of money on co-developing with Sony. So that should mean really, really, really good photos. I don't think there are many other phones out there with a sensor that big. To memory, I think the Sony Xperia Pro I had one, but they cropped quite heavily into it. So I think this is probably the first of its kind to use the full 1-inch.
And what does that mean for users? You know, looking at the phone itself, I mean, the camera module, we always talk about the camera bump, that it looks like a camera on the back.
Yeah, it's massive, and it needs to be, because it's obviously there's a really big sensor inside there. And what that typically means is that the sensors are bigger, the pixels are bigger, so that means they can capture more light, and it also usually means less noise. You get better quality images, because as we've seen when we've pushed the number of megapixels up, sometimes the quality of images degrades because there's so many pixels in a tiny space.
Right.
So having big pixels means better images, essentially. And it's also the first phone, I believe, apart from the iPhone, it's definitely the first Android phone to support Dolby Vision recording as well. So it's got video chops as well as being able to take really good photos.
And do you think that, based on what we've seen from specs, I know we haven't seen the devices themselves, have we? But based on the specs, do you think, is this a lot of hot air? Is it a lot of hype? Or do you think it actually has the potential to deliver?
I think it has the potential to deliver, if only because the past few years, Xiaomi has generally delivered phones with very good camera systems anyway. And so if they're able to lean on Leica's expertise in terms of image quality and color processing, and the lens quality obviously makes a difference as well, then that should enable really good cameras, really competitive cameras. We saw it in the past when Huawei and Leica partnered on cameras on their phones. It led to eventually there being some of the best phones on the market in terms of camera performance. If you think back to, I think it was the P10, delivered some fantastic cameras. So I have high expectations that it could deliver really top of the line camera performance from the Xiaomi as well.
And launch-wise, so this was an announcement in China. It was a fairly big Chinese keynote. I think you watched all 2-3 hours of it, with complete
it
with
sort
long. Of Chinese Frank Sinatra impersonations and all the other stuff, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was a really long announcement, and it was mostly, a lot of it was talking about this Leica partnership. They went really to town on that. And essentially, I mean, it was three phones, and as far as we know, they're staying in China. There's been no news of them launching outside of China, and even when we've asked The answer seems to be there are no plans at the moment. So it sounds like we're not actually going to get these over here.
And why do you think that is? Or do you think that will change in time?
It could change in time. It's something we see from a number of the Chinese manufacturers. It's almost like the Chinese smartphone market moves at a different pace to the Western market. Companies replace phone ranges much quicker over there, every 6 months. Even smaller brands like Realme will do it. They'll release a phone. 6 months later, there'll be a new version of that phone. It's just a very, very fast-paced market, I think, is the big difference. So we might see this technology on a phone, but maybe not the 12S Ultra. Maybe we'll see it in next year's 13 Ultra in around the January time, which is when we typically get the big Xiaomi phones over here.
Still to come, Max gives us his verdict on the Samsung Gaming Hub.
If you've used cloud gaming on your phone or a tablet in your home with your home internet and found it a stable experience, the logic, and Samsung confirmed this, is that it will work exactly that way just on your telly, because really the technology and the streaming is the same.
For the last 20 years, EE has provided the communications infrastructure for the Glastonbury Festival in the UK that each year sees over 200,000 people attend. And with the rise of smartphones use drastically changing in that time and our need and want to be more connected than ever, it's actually involved in making sure that the people that do attend can stay connected over the four-day weekend. Following the festival, I caught up with Sam Kemp, EE's Future Propositions and Innovations Director, who also looks after new propositions for the EE brand and how they use their network for things like standalone 5G, to find out how they made it possible for festival goers to get good coverage. I started by asking what preparations the company does to get ready for the Glastonbury Festival itself.
So, look, it's a huge event, right? Glastonbury, it's a nearly 250,000 individuals descending on Worthy Farm. And I think what we do at EE is we look at all major events across the year, and we put in extra capacity across festivals, major tournaments, and national events, and even brand activations. We specifically for Glastonbury, we put in about 7 to 10 temporary masts.
Right.
Two of those are already existing today, and those masts that go in allow us to really optimize the network and ensure that we can deliver the sort of optimal performance that we believe festivals goers need on today's demands on social media and sharing.
You obviously do this for a number of different places. Glastonbury has its own sort of excitement because probably the sheer scale of people. So what are the unique challenges to getting, making sure those 250,000 people that turn up have the ability to make phone calls or share data or, get the internet or what have you?
Yeah, indeed. I think the unique challenges are that it's the flow of people, with major cities and towns, it's relatively easy for us to predict and scale our mobile networks to meet the demand and capacity of our monthly and pay-monthly users. But for festival goers, of course, with many different stages and not knowing exactly which acts are going to drive the big crowds in, we have to kind of really map out the way we're going to deliver the infrastructure to deliver what we believe is that right optimum experience. So not only getting in the temporary sites, but getting in the backhaul, doing all of the testing with a wide range of mobile devices that we do on site. And then we have all the environmental impacts as well, whether it be weather, wind or other environmental conditions that can degrade a mobile service.
And so in the sense of with Glastonbury, was that kind of, do you talk with the organisers to say, right, who do you think is going to be the big band that everybody wants to go and see? Oh, these guys are on this stage. To be honest, that's not a huge band that everybody's interested in, so we don't need to. Are you pushing like sort of connectivity around in like real time, so to speak? Like Paul McCartney was playing on the Saturday night. Does that drive more effort for that, yeah, that couple of hours, and therefore you somewhere else on the site it's not so much, or
yeah,
how do you plan for that?
It's interesting because the networks aren't quite self-optimized networks, so they don't grow and scale as the capacity shifts around the site. In fact, the installations that we put in are static. However, what we do is we have a conversation with the Glastonbury teams up front, and we try and understand headline acts, what times there are on particular stages, who do we think is going to be more popular than not. That's very much a predictive exercise. But what we also do is we run the Glastonbury application itself. So we can look back in historic data and we can plan to see expected volumes for those peak right. stages that go on through the festival. What's really interesting is, well, it's not just the peak stages that drive the demand. It's those returning back to campsites to share pictures and images with loved ones that are outside of the festivals. But it's always the runways and the people management solutions in terms of moving people from one end of the festival all the way up to the other between headline acts drives up a load of capacity where people are, again, finding individuals, finding where, you know, loved ones are, or taking that moment to share a picture up onto social media.
And so how has the usage changed? I mean, I know EE's been involved in the Glastonbury partnership for almost 20 years now, I think. That's a big difference in the way that the phones that we have capability, you know, access to, but also the way that we use our phones. How have you seen that uses change over the last two decades?
Hugely. And in fact, before the festival, we predicted about 200 terabytes of data to actually be consumed and used at the festival. And the numbers are in, and we're about 196 terabytes of data that was consumed, which is an incredible amount. And in fact, we had a little bit of fun earlier just trying to decompose and realize what 196 terabytes of data actually is. And that's about 8 billion Instagram posts or 6 million downloads. And compared to 2019, which saw about 100 terabytes of data, it's a twice increase on 2019's data. So, yeah.
And so is that, what were the big trends in terms of, was it Instagram posts or are people, can you see that granular of whether people are taking photos and uploading them, or whether that's texts or phone calls or just people streaming concerts, you know, like watching iPlayer or elsewhere around the thing because they can't get to that gig?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a hybrid between application usage and social media. So we tend not to dive into, you know, what are individuals specifically doing. But the big social platforms, the Instagram live streaming, Snapchat, YouTube uploads are, of course, within the top number. But of course, voice calls that are held over data channels these days. And we saw 3.4 million voice calls made over the Glastonbury weekend. Mm. And that's an increase of about 200,000 compared to 2019. So this increase we're seeing is not just application and data sharing usage, it's just general communication. So even an increase in voice traffic has increased over 2019.
Now, you always get this thing of when there's lots of people and you try to send, you know, a message or you try to talk to someone, you can't get through. There's, you know, just the sheer numbers of people trying to make that call. This is probably a question you might not be able to answer, but what do people do at an event like this that doesn't help? that really just kind of pushes extra demand. I mean, sometimes if you're on a website, for example, and it's not loading, hitting that refresh over and over again actually doesn't help you because it kind of clogs the server up even more. And so is there anything that people do at events like this where you just think, oh, if only they'd stop doing that, then everybody would be able to get through it. It'd be fine.
Yeah, we're relatively lucky because the mechanics of the way of mobile technology works these days, that, you know, as many times as you press a refresh button, it doesn't constantly send a request back to the network because of the intelligence at the application level. However, definitely video upload and the request for network bandwidth is an activity that the network will constantly look to serve. Because unlike scrolling an Instagram feed where you can keep, you know, pulling down on the feed, and if there just isn't the bandwidth there to serve it, it will go through its specific cyclic check and wait for it to be a bandwidth to become available. But for video upload, the more users that request that type of service from the network sees it as a priority and starts to then allocate resource to those types of activities. And that can definitely see some size types of CPU utilization move up both on the device and on the network for those types of requests. But broadly speaking, there aren't many transactions which individuals can really, you know, affect the overall performance of a network.
Now, we're a couple of years into 5G and, you know, and all the other stuff. Are you seeing, what did you see quite a strong, you know, pickup of 5G usage at the show? You know, not the show, the festival, or, yeah. Or is it still predominantly kind of, you know, 3G and 4G usage?
No, I mean, look, as you know, we launched 5G back in 2019, and I was very surprised and pleased to see that a good 15 to 20% of the traffic we carried, EE carried at the festival was 5G traffic. And those that are on 5G, we know were able to execute and undertake a better performance because they were able to get access to greater bandwidth, greater capacity and greater speed. And of course, with greater speed allows individuals to complete their transactions that little bit quicker than on 4G. So it really helps from an efficiency perspective because then they can fall back to 4G for those less intensive applications. But about 15 to 20% of the traffic we carried was over 5G. So there's still a healthy and strong 4G presence within our base. But of course, the networks, even on 4G, delivered a nearly faultless experience over the festival weekend.
And you talk about, you know, earlier you're talking about lots of different stats and you've had some fun with them and things like that. What's been the biggest surprise to you when you look over, you know, the festival and how it went? Is there anything you thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's something we need to be aware of for perhaps next time.
I think that when we look at the data and we see this sort of twofold increase in both data usage and still, you know, a 2,000 increased voice call uplift over 2019, I think the beauty between of a festival weekend where you immerse yourself in some of the world's and UK's best acts in the musical arena, coupled with high-end technology, because seeing individuals sharing pictures with loved ones that aren't at the festival, or locating individuals that have been lost, maybe going to the bar, or even sitting on the shoulders of others with a phone in one hand, trying to both celebrate the moment of being in front of the pyramid stage, but also capture that present moment for future use, just leads us to believe that, you know, this integration between in real life experiences and capturing those moments is not going to be something that slows down. And I'm incredibly excited because I think some of the future technologies that are ahead of us are going to allow that integration between sort of disconnected festival experiences and capturing moments to a level that really allows the customer to do a lot more, a lot easier.
Samsung announced and released its new gaming hub swiftly at the very end of last month, avoiding the sort of long wait that we sometimes experience with interesting new features coming to its range of televisions. It means that anyone with a Samsung 2022 TV, that's one that you bought this year, can now take advantage of some Swift gaming features within the TV itself. Pocalypse's Max Freeman-Mills has already had a play and joins us to tell us more. So, Max, probably let's just start. I know I've kind of detailed slightly there, but let's start by explaining what it is, what it allows you to do, and then we can talk about what you thought about it.
Yeah, that's probably smart. I mean, Gaming Hub is quite a nice little name, but until you see it in action, it's quite hard to get a grip on exactly what Samsung's offering. Effectively, it's a new section on your smart TV alongside sort of input sources and settings. So it's really right in the home menu of your TV that offers you a whole range of gaming related apps. So the real headline grabbers here is that there are a few game streaming apps built right into the hub, meaning you can use services like Xbox Cloud Gaming and Google Stadia and a couple of others without any hardware at all beyond a Bluetooth controller.
So in that sense, you've got everybody that's got this year's television from Samsung now has effectively an Xbox in the TV.
That's right. I mean, it's surprising in that we've known that cloud gaming is a huge focus for Xbox kind of in the future pipeline. But this almost feels like we're skipping a couple of years forward. It's just suddenly out there. You need no hardware. It's no longer tied to a phone or a tablet. It's right there on your TV. There are a few shortcomings compared to playing on, for example, an Xbox Series X. But if you don't want to spend £450 on a console, this is a really good way to get started, especially if you've got, what, admittedly is, by definition, quite a fancy television, because for now it's only on the newest of Samsung's always quite premium TVs. But it's a really impressive feature. And yeah, getting hands-on with it was an interesting experience, because it's one of those products that is impressive almost because it just does what it says on the tin.
And that was going to be my next question. We've kind of explained what it does and how it works. And does the hype, and let's start that again. Does the reality live up to the hype?
Well, this is the thing. I think it may. So long as you know the restrictions that you're working with, and I'll detail those first because there aren't that many of them, that the most fundamental is that the game streaming, which is all done via the cloud, is up to a limit of 1080p resolution right now. It can go to 60 frames per second, so it's nice and smooth, but you're not going to get the incredibly crisp 4K resolution that you could get from an actual physical console at the moment. If that's fine, and it will be for many people, the service works just as it's advertised. All you need is minimum of 10 megabytes per second, and ideally, Samsung says, really, it's 20 plus. And whether you're on Wi-Fi or wired, you're going to get a stable streaming experience. So I played a bunch of Halo Infinite using it, connecting an Xbox controller through Bluetooth to the TV, which is also a nice and simple process. And there was pretty much no discernible latency in my controls. I could tell that it wasn't 4K, but I was prepared for that, so that's not really a problem. Mm. And in fact, I asked them if 4K was something they were working on, and unsurprisingly, not only did an Xbox spokesperson clarify, yes, we definitely are working on it, they were happy enough to say it's not a matter of if it'll come, it's a matter of when it will come. This is a huge initiative for Xbox, so any feature you encounter that you think might be missing, there's a pretty high chance that they know it and that it will come eventually.
And so you said there that you played and you felt that it was responsive and all the other stuff. You played the Xbox. Is it the same across the other services that are in that gaming hub? Is there kind of just apps as well that you can just play without having to sign up to other streaming services? And how easy was it to use?
So it's very... Hub is actually the right word in that it hosts whatever apps are kind of compatible. So at the moment, the four that we were able to see present were Xbox Game Cloud Gaming, Stadia, NVIDIA GeForce Now, and Atomic. The language being used means that it's perfectly possible there will be other services, although really the first three of those are the kind of most commonly used ones. I wasn't able to get hands-on with anything other than Xbox Cloud Gaming. Having said that, my experience of cloud gaming was very much, if you've used cloud gaming on your phone or a tablet mm-hmm. in your home with your home internet and found it a stable experience, the logic, and Samsung confirmed this, is that it will work exactly that way just on your telly, because really the technology and the streaming is the same. So if you want, for example, to check if one of these services would be a fit for your home, there's nothing stopping you using it on whatever hardware you do have now and waiting for a potential arrival on your TV. Because the other elephant in the room from Samsung's point of view is that this tech is very likely to make it to other TV platforms. There's no exclusivity that I can discern with Samsung. I asked Xbox if they were working with other TV partners. They are. So you can bet that, you know, other big TVs will be getting these features eventually. It's just that Samsung's managed to get things in line nice and quickly and is the first out of the gate. So it's an interesting, I mean, I just think it's a very interesting step. As I say, it's come earlier than I expected in the lifespan of Xbox Cloud Gaming, but it really does feel, you know, kind of futuristic when you're doing it. The fact that there's no set-top box, there's no bulky, power-hungry console at all. You're just in and gaming.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next time, thanks for listening. Pip, pip.